Welcome to Minnesota Stories. I'm your host, Tyler Coleman. Today I sit down with Steve Dowling. Now, I've met with Steve a number of times, but I had even forgotten some of the amazing things that he'd been involved in. Most are related to ice hockey, as he was a player and a referee, but also in the movies. He was actually the referee in the movie The Mighty Ducks, but that's just the start of the amazing stories that he has. So, thanks for joining us and enjoy Steve Dowling's Minnesota Story. Okay, so I'm here with Steve Dowling. Need to apologize because we've already had a wonderful conversation for the past few minutes with me failing to press record. But I think it'll help us to get more in-depth and more succinct at some of these amazing things that you've been doing. So, Steve, you've had a number of really interesting things happen in your life, but I think we kind of go back to the start of where you grew up and playing hockey, because hockey was obviously a big part of your life. Can you just take us back to where you grew up and kind of how you grew up playing hockey and maybe some other sports?
Yeah, originally from Massachusetts, a small town south of Boston called Hingham, right on the Atlantic Ocean. It was a beautiful place to grow up. But in that area, like a lot of the greater Boston area, the sports were pretty focused, I think, in terms of attention of fans to hockey. And, you know, therefore, as a kid, there were a lot of kids that grew up and they're playing hockey. And I think I started probably at 4 or 5 years old and on a pond. And most of the experience back then in those days was outdoors, and I think you had to go on the south shore of Boston. There was probably one indoor rink, so your activity was going to be outdoors, and you could not be limited to 1 hour of ice time. You could play for all day if you want.
So growing up on the ocean, and sorry if this is stereotypical, but was your dad a fisherman?
No, my dad died when I was 9 years old.
So, okay.
It was very oriented to history. A unique thing about the town I grew up in, this is way off topic right now.
No such thing.
So, Boston Tea Party, you know, occurred. What it was, but the ship that sailed into Boston Harbor with the tea on it was staged in this little harbor called Hingham, and so they filled up the ship there, and they sent it on up, and the town was incorporated in 1635. So that gives you a sense of, you know, some of the history and some of the aging that were around the greater Boston area, and it was an influence in many things that occurred, because history was, you know, very, very important, and people had an orientation to history, whether it was past history, and in certain cases, I think they were attentive to things that were happening during those days that were to become future history. But it was an interesting place to grow up.
Yeah, I haven't spent much time on the East Coast. I just remember being charmed when I went to a Dunkin' Donuts and someone said one of the kinds of donuts was wicked good. that was my experience in the Boston area. So you were playing hockey. Played for a high school team?
Right, yeah.
And then where'd you go after that?
After that, it was Boston College. Recruited pretty decently, I think, and I ended up with a scholarship at Boston College.
So when you say recruited, I imagine recruiting was different than it is today in most college sports, where you get, you know, 25 different schools sending you letters, but is that how it was back then too?
Yeah, you'd get a letter. I mean, that would that would be at the word, it'd get around, and all of a sudden you'd get a letter from Brown University or BU or even, and I don't know what I ever would have done with that, but North Dakota. You know, way back then, it's like, North Dakota, I'm not even sure where that is.
So were you winning state titles in high school that these schools knew about you? Because, you know, it's not like today where you have YouTube.
We did in the league that we played in. It was a pretty good league. For 2 years, I was the highest scorer in the state of Massachusetts. And I think that, you know, that becomes pretty common knowledge because there was only one or two newspapers back then, and there wasn't a lot of news to cover. So, you know, the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald that have the South Shore League scorers and a little article, you never find that right now if you go to the Boston Globe to find out all those individual leagues or whatever. Mm-hmm. So without PR, there was PR just because the team played pretty well. It played in a solid league.
So you went to Boston College. Was that always the dream? Was that kind of seen as, you know, now as an alumni, I expect that you're completely biased. But if you can think back to when you were in high school, was that the goal that everybody wanted to play for Boston College?
You know, Boston College was one of four Division I schools in the greater Boston, just in the greater Boston area. Of course, all in New England was pretty heavy on Division I schools then. Then there was the Eastern College Athletic Conference, the ECAC, and that was the conference that played. So if you were a good high school hockey player, you were going to be recruited by likely, you know, one of those New England schools in the ECAC. So BC, BU, Boston University, and in Harvard was in the greater Boston area. And Northeastern was in the greater Boston area, and those teams form the core of the Division I schools. They have a tournament every single year, and it's gone back, I don't know how many years now, 50, 60, who knows how many years, called the Beanpot Tournament, and it's played at Boston Garden every year, the first and second Mondays of February. And BC, BU, Harvard, and Northeastern play in that every single year. It's very competitive. It sells out Boston Garden every year. It has never failed to sell it out. So BC was a school that you'd want to go play for because it was a top-notch school, but there'd be as much recruiting done by BU or, depending on your academics, the Ivy League schools that were in the area, Dartmouth and Yale and Brown. It's kind of a little interesting sidelight, and I think that it's okay to tell this story now because so much time has passed. But when BU recruited me after a high school game, the assistant coach at Boston University, can't tell you his name, I think he's passed.
Is this a new recruiting scandal?
It is, kind of.
Sure.
Jack Kelly was the head coach there, and Jack Kelly is kind of a unique individual. He ended up coaching the Pittsburgh Penguins, and his son is David E. Kelly, which is...
It's the TV producer?
The TV producer or whatever. So, but one game on a Friday night, the assistant coach from Boston University came to the game, and then afterwards... a family member, my mother and myself, we went out for, you know, a frap, New England talk for milkshake. I can't tell his name. He, at this meeting, he leaned to my mother and said, "You've got a younger sister coming along. I think if we get things tied up here, we could probably have your younger sister come along on scholarship also." Now, she wasn't an athlete. She wasn't an academic genius, but somehow this was going to happen. A few weeks later, that item was withdrawn. So I guess somebody came to their senses as to what was going on. But it gives you a sense of how competitive they could be with just so few universities there after what would be considered, you know, a couple of the top players in the state
Sure.
being eligible.
Well, I try not to get too political here or get into too many scandals, but I think probably after that amount of time, we're probably going to be okay. But, yeah, these things happen. They happen then, and they continue to happen today.
Yeah.
So what was your career like at Boston College? You play all 4 years?
At that time, you weren't allowed to play as a freshman.
Okay.
So they had freshman teams that played against freshman teams, the whole freshman league, but I played the remaining 3 years there, and I was a captain in 1968.
Okay. And competed against some pretty amazing players, and how far did you guys make it? Did you win a national championship or Frozen Four or something like that?
Yeah. In my sophomore year, we played in the Frozen Four. In my senior year, we played in the Frozen Four, and playing against some pretty good players, Cornell, Dryden, and we played in the Frozen Four. And my senior year, we played against Denver, and they had Coral, Wistie, Magnuson, who became, for a number of years, the core players at the Chicago Blackhawks. And and I think I mentioned this in an earlier conversation, but, I've scored against Ken Dryden. And that kind of makes me feel good. But in actual fact, it was probably late in the game, didn't make any difference. It was in college.
It's still something that there's a lot of people can't say that they have. So were you drafted to the NHL then, or what were your prospects as a professional after college?
Well, at that time, in those eras, when I was in high school, there was no draft. They had what they called negotiating lists. So the teams, the original six teams, would probably illegal today, but they would decide who was going to be on their negotiating list. So Boston picked a guy named Orr when he was probably 12 or 13 years old, and Chicago picked a guy named, Hall or something like that. And then from there on in, they would bring him and see if they wanted to, play for the team and probably assign him to some minor, junior teams in Canada. There weren't that many opportunities. So the draft wasn't a big deal. It really was non-existent. But I was on the negotiating list, if you will, of the Boston Bruins when I was in high school, and was brought to rookie camp outside of Niagara Falls. And it was a week-long rookie camp, and one of the kids sitting next to me was a blonde kid, 14 years old. I'm 16 years old. And a blonde kid coming out his first year in the OHA, which is the Ontario Hockey Association, and as an all-star. And now the OHA at that time played up to 19 years old. And at 19 years old, you're, a young adult, you're big and physical. At 14 years old, you're just, getting your ears wet, so to speak. But he's coming out as an all-star in the OHA.
He might have been the youngest guy in the league by 2 years at 14.
I don't know, but he played. His name is Bobby Orr.
So at that camp, did you realize that he was something special?
Yeah, he was the real deal back then. I mean, you'd be in camp, in a rookie camp that might have 30 guys there or something like that. But as you walk through the door the first day, you know exactly who, was the focus of any spotlights that's going to go on in that little dark, dingy rink for a rookie camp. And he was it. So.
We're going to get into your acting career in a few minutes, but I think from a past conversation, it started while you were at Boston College, correct?
Yeah, it did.
So can you explain kind of that story?
Yeah, it was, there was a movie called Love Story with Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw, and Ryan O'Neal was, the storyline was that he was a student at Harvard, and he played hockey. And so they, as part of it, they had a weekend where they shot background for hockey scenes, and they utilized players from the four Division I schools in Boston, BC, BU, Harvard, and Northeastern. And the casting director was a woman, and she got a hold of the captains of each one of the schools. And I was a captain at BC, and Jack Parker, who was eventually the coach at Boston University for decades, was a captain at BU. David Poiley, who's now the GM at the Nashville Predators, he was the captain at Northeastern, and Jack Garrity, a scholar. What else did they have at Harvard? But scholars got a hold of us and said, "Hey, can you bring five guys to a weekend over to the rink at Watson Rink at Harvard, and we'll pay you, I think it was $75 for the weekend, and you're going to be in a movie, or you're going to be background in a movie." So
you're going to be a movie star.
You're going to be a movie star. You know, whatever. So, just, I mean, I'll carry the story on here, but about 2 weeks, this is going to be shot in like late April or early May. So the casting director was getting a little nervous that some of these guys that had committed might not show up because it's golf season and, you know, the weather's getting good and, you know, it's not necessarily hockey. So she got a hold of me and each one of the other three guys and said, "Hey, you guys can make it. Get your guys." "I got my guys. Yeah, I got my guys for that." "You sure they're going to make it?" "Oh, yeah. No, they're all committed. We're going to be there." And she said, "I'm not 100% sure if this is accurate or not, but I hear that for those guys that attend, they'll be able to go over to Cambridge and watch a love story with Ally McGraw." Now, Ally McGraw is, at that time, you can't drool enough to even make it feel good, but she was terrific. So we get to the rink, we do the weekend shoot, they come around with the checks, and they hand out the checks, and guys are sitting there and elbowing each other, saying, hey, what do you hear about Cambridge? What do you hear?" It was a hoax. It was only to make sure that they had enough guys to...
They knew what would motivate the college guys to get out was to meet this starlet. So that launched a career in movies. You became a huge movie star. So we met when we were going to play golf one day in Lakeville. And when I was coming to meet you, I knew that you had been a professional referee. And as a hockey player, I'm not usually too excited about seeing a referee. But after our talk, I could tell you I have mentioned your name hundreds of times at least, because you were the referee in the Mighty Ducks that spoke to Gordon Bombay, that told him that there was a penalty shot, and we'll get to the call, because the call wasn't exactly, you know, by Hoyle's rules for hockey. But how did you start, or I guess what happened after that one movie that led you to be in a lot of other ones?
For the most part, it was let's see how we can phrase this here. There was an opportunity that just came out of the blue, just because of being in the area, for Slapshot to be, not cast in that, but, you know, beyond their.
So we're talking about the iconic hockey movie played in every bus trip of a junior hockey team since it was made.
Yeah, and it was in Johnstown, and so I'm on the credits, you know, for that. So, but that wasn't a big deal, but. After that...
So what did you do in that?
I was a referee.
You were a referee for kind of the footage of them on the ice.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that was a good question. And then coming out of that, I was done with my professional career, if you will, as a referee. And there was a group that... played 9 seasons, if you will, that was a combination of NHL all-stars and Hollywood-type people.
So where were they playing?
They play all over the country.
Okay.
So they would do games for charity, sometimes 3 per year, sometimes 9 per year. It really, you know, really depended. And I was their referee.
Okay.
By accident, I was their referee. So they'd be playing, they happened to be playing in Boston, and I was
involved. So who were some of the names that were playing in this?
Well, so you'd have Makita, Hull. It would go on the Hollywood side. It would be Matthew Perry, Jason Priestley.
Dave Coulier, was he one of the organizers of that one?
He was involved. The guy that organized it was a guy in Southern California. But, and I forget his name, but the primary guy was a guy named Jack White. Now, Jack White was in Hollywood because he was an animator. And he was originally from outside of Detroit, Windsor. So he played some hockey, and then he's down in the greater L.A. area playing hockey, and there are a lot of transplanted Canadians playing hockey down there, Priestley and some of these other guys. And they finally came across the idea that, hey, maybe we can do some of these celebrity games. We'll get a hold of some of the, you know, NHL guys, and we'll play these things around for, you know, for charity. So we played in Boston, Pittsburgh, Calgary, L.A., literally all over the country. We did one in Radisson, Saskatchewan. And the reason for that is that that's where, I guess, Gordie Howe grew up. And that was his little town. His little rink was falling apart. So in Saskatoon, they had a fundraiser to build this rink back up again. So we were up there, you know, to do that. But some of the interesting characters were the coaches, the celebrity coaches. So George Wendt would be, you know, from Cheers, Norm. Kelsey Grammer. Ventura was a coach. There were a lot of interesting people that were on those teams. So typically the team would go and play against the alumni of a team. So the very first one that I became involved in was in Boston. I was living in Minnesota, but I worked for a company that was a sponsor of that event in Boston. So it's the Boston Bruins alumni versus the Hollywood NHL All-Stars. And so they said, hey, you're a sponsor, you know, you're refereeing history, why don't you go do that? So I went and did that game, and after the game, Jack White, who has been, and maybe still is, the technical advisor for hockey for Hollywood, came to me and said, hey, we want to do a couple more of these games here. We got, you know, a couple more coming up. We never know what we're going to get for a referee. You seem to know your way around, and you're okay with a camera and all this other stuff. And I said, sure. And then that led to 9 years of four, five, six times, getting on an airplane, going someplace, treated like a celebrity, limo service like all those guys get, and doing those. And Jack, because he was the technical advisor for Hollywood, anytime that there was a hockey film, they got a hold of him. And so when the Mighty Ducks thing came up, he called me and said, hey, I'm going to shoot a movie in the greater Minneapolis area. It's got a couple of scenes in it for a referee. What do you think? So I said, sure, that's fine. And that led to Mighty Ducks 2, Mighty Ducks 3, a Hollywood Hockey Cup, which was a Comedy Central one-hour special, Beverly Hills 90210, because Priestley did that. I mean, that was his series, and he likes hockey, so he talked to the writers, had a hockey scene in there. And so, you know, I got a call from Jack White, said, hey, we're going to do a Beverly Hills 90210. We need a character for, you know, a referee. Come on out to Century City and do that. Sure, you know, I can do that. So, and then there were a couple. The Cutting Edge was one, but I was on the cutting room floor in Hamilton, Ontario. We shot that, but that was on it.
And that's an underrated movie. I've told people that. Sometimes I've tricked people saying it's a hockey movie when it's actually a figure skating movie.
Yeah, it is.
That's pretty good. Yeah. So your scenes didn't make it on that, but you still filmed for it.
Yeah.
Yep.
In Hamilton. Nice little place.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, lucky to be able to say that I've had those experiences. They really don't mean anything. They're just someone has to sit there or stand there or do whatever it is. But you know, in life's experiences, it's fun to look back. It's fun to done stuff.
That hurts me to say that being a part of the Mighty Ducks didn't mean anything.
No, I don't want to say that. No.
I'm telling you, when I tell people that I've met the referee from the Mighty Ducks, they're in awe. That's more than any of these stars that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned this earlier, but Steve Brill was the writer, and he became a friend during when we shot that. We just had a lot in common. But so the one particular scene that you're talking about is in the championship game at the end.
It's the climax.
Yeah. And Charlie Conway, he gets hooked. He turned into a famous actor.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what his
Joshua Jackson. He was on Dawson's Creek.
Yeah, and a number of other ones. So we get to the scene, and I'm reading I have lines in that, and I get my lines in the morning. We're going to shoot. Sometimes it took 2 days to do stuff that took 2 minutes. But I went to Brill and I said, Steve, this is the wrong call. Well, what do you mean? I said, well, right. The script reads. I go to Emilio and say, hey, coach, penalty shot for the Ducks. Anyone on the ice can take it. But in actual fact, Charlie's been hooked down, and it's the player that hooked him. The player that gets hooked, rather, that takes the penalty shot. He looked at me and said, you're probably right, but stick with it.
So there was a little internal turmoil, though, of calling the wrong call?
Well, yeah. And so I kind of say, okay, well, this is what it's like. And then not too long after the film aired, I'd get a call or an email or something from, a former fellow NHL referee. Hey, Steve, you made the wrong call. In the movie, they call and say, you made the wrong call in the movie. So it's just a movie.
It's just a movie. But it's pretty neat. After we met, I went to YouTube. So anybody who's listening to this can go to YouTube. And I think, I forget exactly what I searched. Probably Steve Dowling, Mighty Ducks or something like that. So you can find that clip of where you come over and your acting is fantastic.
Oh,
surprised you didn't win an Oscar for it or something.
Right.
No, you did it. You did a good job though. Because most of the time you weren't doing speaking roles, correct, right, on all these? Except for making calls and that, but no, you did a good job. That whole thing's been fascinating. I've told a lot of people, but that's not the only interesting. You just kind of glazed over it, but you were a professional referee for a time. How did you get into that? Were you a referee through high school and college, or they're starting to recruit referees now? They're having to find guys that can skate and know the game enough. But what was your path to being a professional referee?
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the playing experience, and I played through college, and then I ended up in an era where you, as an American, were either going to get drafted or you're going to join, or that was going to be it. So I spent 3 years an officer in the U.S.
And that's to the military.
That's in the U.S. Army.
Yeah, drafted or joined.
Military. I'm sorry. Yeah,
no, that's okay.
Into the military. It was the Vietnam area type of item. And as I finished up, I was stationed at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and I was playing a little bit of hockey in a league called the New England Hockey League, a little bit under the auspices of the Boston Bruins. And then I had a kind of an injury to my knee, and that required some surgery, but nothing that was that was major. But besides my playing skills, the injury was a good excuse to say my hockey career is over. So I got involved then with a little bit of officiating, and even while I was at Fort Devens, and then I continued a little bit beyond that. And so through a connection or another connection, I did some high school and a couple of other items. And at that time, into the American Hockey League, there was a team coming called the Boston Braves, which was a minor league team in the American Hockey League for the Boston Bruins. And the way the American Hockey League works is that they have referees in the American Hockey League back then that were NHL trainees or NHL referees. It wasn't necessarily a trainee down then. They just assigned guys to that. And the linesmen were local linesmen. So there'd be a linesman that would be, you know, local college or whatever. So when the NHL did all the assigning of that, when the team came into existence, they went to the Bruins and they said, hey, you know what, we're going to need a few local linesmen around here. Who do you have, who do you know of that officiates that can become a local linesman? And they said, well, you know, Dowling used to be part of our organization. We know you're doing some officiating. Why don't you call him? So they called me, and Frank Advari was the, one of the supervisors of officials back then. And they had a training camp in Hershey. And guys that would come from each one of the teams in the American Hockey League that would be, you know, part-time linesmen would go there. So we went, it was a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So we get there, and you do all through the training, all through the stuff that you're supposed to learn, or they're testing you and whatever. And the combination was going to be a game at Hershey between the Hershey Bears and preseason game and another team. I think it was Baltimore at that time, and I can't remember the name of the team. It's not the Skipjacks, but it was, you know, before then. So you're in the room, and Vardy comes around and they say, so-and-so, you work the first 10 minutes of the first period, so-and-so, you work the second 10 minutes of it, you know, as a linesman, whatever. So I forget what my assignment was, the second 10 minutes of the second period. And just before the game's going to start, 15, 20 minutes before the game's going to start, Vari comes into the room and says, hey, you know what? The NHL forgot to assign a referee. Who's had some refereeing experience? I don't know.
Put your hand up.
Dowling, you skated pretty well out there. Okay, you take the first period, so-and-so the second. So I did the first period. And it was a little bit of a barn burner type thing. And Vari comes to me after the first period and said, hey, Steve, work the second period. Finish the game. And so now I'm in the, you know, the sights of Vari and the NHL as a referee, not a linesman. And Vari comes to me on Sunday and said, look, we're full on our staff now, but I want you to think about making sure you work as much as you can in the American League as a linesman, get plenty of experience, work as many other games as you can throughout the season, and we'll talk next year and see if you can come to our NHL camp as a referee. Great? Okay. So I went and did that. In the spring, I get a call from Scotty Morrison, who's the referee in chief of the NHL, and he says, hey, we're about to enter into, this is 1972, an event that's pretty big, and the negotiations are Russia and Canada, that there's going to be no Russian referees, there'll be no Canadian referees, so there'll be Americans and Europeans.
And at the time in the NHL, I would expect most of the referees were Canadian.
There were no Americans.
Right.
In 1972, when I did sign that contract, I was the first American since 1949. To do that. So I ended up refereeing in Team Canada Russia series in 1970.
So just to hold up there a second, I think a lot of listeners wouldn't understand this. This series in 1972 between the USSR and Canada was expected to be a barn burner, where Canada, that had all the NHL stars, was going to just destroy these closed communist Olympians that were still supposed amateurs. And it ended up being really close, to the point where, like, they shut down schools in Canada to watch these games. And it's like, literally, they teach this in schools about it being an integral part of Canadian history, of Canada seeing itself as a nation in the world and all this kind of stuff. So where you're saying you're signing a contract for this little thing, this is to be a part of something that was really meaningful two countries to see where they were at in a sport that was really the only sport they cared about at the time.
Yeah, I mean, even till today, if I come across a Canadian of age, you know, occasionally in the right environment, I can ask them, where were you during the Team Canada Russia series in 1972? And they will look at me and they'll tell me exactly. I was in Miss Smith's room. They brought a TV in, blah, 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 blah. And it's a big business. The Americans have no idea. I mean, it was probably carried on, you know, TV here, and it was, you know, in a number of publications and.
But in Canada, my dad's story is that they took him out of class, and everybody went to the gymnasium where there was one TV, and they all watched it.
Yeah, all eight games.
Yeah. So did you referee the ones just in North America, or did you go over there as well?
No, just in Canada. The first game was in Montreal, and the Russians won it. The Canadian staff there. Their bench with primarily skilled players, the skilled players against what they considered to be skilled players from Russia. And at the end of the event, the Montreal Forum at that time was very formal. They would almost be a black tie to go to the Montreal Forum to go to hockey games. And very subdued, if you will. At 5 minutes after the end of the game, the Montreal Forum, the Russians have won, the Canadians have lost, and no one in that arena had moved 5 minutes afterwards. They're frozen. This is not supposed to happen. This is unbelievable stuff. From there, the tactics were a certain amount of predictability, and I'm going to referee the second game in Toronto, and I get a call during the afternoon to say, it looks like the Canadians have changed their lineup now to be a little more physical. So they've got Cashman in there, and, you know, who knows who else. I mean, you know, Bobby Clark is in there, and this is going to be a totally different game, which it was. And it turned out the Canadians won that game. It's the only one they won in Canada. There were eight games, four in Canada, four in the USSR. It's the only one the Canadians won in Canada. So they lost in Montreal, they tied in Winnipeg, and they lost in Vancouver. And, you know, for me, it was meaningful, I mean, even till today for a number of reasons. But one of it was that it was almost career-ending, or I thought it might have meant career-ending, that I'd never started. Because the number one player for Russia was a guy named Karlamov. And Karlamov was really, really, really good. I hope I pronounced that right. And in the sequence of plays, he had taken a penalty, or one of his teammates had taken a penalty. And in attendance was the referee-in-chief of the NHL, Scotty Morrison, who is referee in chief. This is the guy that's going to sign the other side of my NHL contract. Now, the Canadians never told the Russians that I was due to be an NHL referee, because they would have kind of fought that, because they thought maybe conflict of interest. So, in any case, Karlamov, there's a penalty, there's a high stick penalty, and has to do with Makita. Makita is about the only guy wearing a helmet, and you can't miss the high stick because you can hear the helmet get dinged. And so I got a Russian guy for a high stick, and I start to go over to call that in, and Karlamov comes over to me, and he physically bumps me. So, you know, I've got the penalty, then I've got a misconduct for Karlamov. The Russians are, you know, just livid. But right behind the glass of where I'm calling this penalty is Scotty Morrison. Now, Scotty Morrison loves Canada. He's right there at the glass, and he is screaming at me, throw him out of the game, throw him out of the game, game misconduct. And I just took a breath and said, I'm going with the misconduct. So misconduct.
10 minutes?
10-minute misconduct, yep. Rather than a game misconduct. So I go back to my hotel that evening, and there's a message. Mr. Morrison would like to see you in his office in Rexdale tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Okay. Now, I'm due to become the first American to be a referee in the NHL. My thought is, it's not going to happen. Scotty Morrison, a couple of hours ago, was screaming over the glass that give him a game misconduct rather than a misconduct. So I go to his office and, you know, I've convinced myself that game over for me. He says, Steve, I've got your contract right here. I'm tearing it up. Oh, fuck. I'm done. He said, I got another one right here. And it's got a little bit better terms in it. He said, the reason is, last night, I was a Canadian. I had Canada written all over my forehead. I wasn't paying attention to what was going on. You made the right call. It's a misconduct for a bump. It's not a game misconduct. So, you know, that was, you know, a memorable type of a situation. And he's really a quality individual.
Sure.
You know, he's a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame as an official.
Well, you were talking, I was trying to think of something so that people can understand. This is basically Rocky IV. The movie Rocky IV, in that the Russians came over to North America and going against the champs, all the Canadians, and then they had to actually go back as the underdog to Russia and end up winning in this famous goal. But that was that you were part of it, and that played a part in your career because you were making the right move. I can't imagine the pressure of making that decision with the person who holds your future in their hand, literally holding it in their hand, and making that. So obviously you're a man of integrity. Oh, that's fascinating. We could talk about that for years, but I don't think most people are as interested in it as I am as a Canadian. So after hockey, though, and you worked in films, but you're currently doing what most hockey players do after hockey, which is work with golf.
Right.
Can you explain to me, and I don't even know the extent of this, all I know is that whenever I've been with you anywhere near a golf course, you seem to know everybody involved. And that you've done some writing, but what is it that you're doing now?
I'm mostly retired. I spent, after hockey, more than 15 years as kind of a senior guy with Northwest Airlines. And then after the buyout of Northwest, which treated me pretty well even to this day, I ended up working for the PGA Tour, a division called PGA Tour Golf Properties. And they build and market golf courses under the heading of TPCs. So my last project was the TPC of the Twin Cities, which is here. It was good. But one of the investors, and the way that the PGA Tour builds a golf course called TPCs, is that in the first 5 years, they have an outside investor that'll have 49% of the investment in building the golf course. After 5 years, the tour buys that individual or that group out. So the particular group here, the TPC of the Twin Cities, was a local contract, a very successful Ennebec Construction. And he came to me just as the TPC was opening and said he had a major, major investment in a number of golf courses that he had built, and that he didn't have any marketing. And he wanted to know if I could set up a marketing program for the 6 or 8 golf courses that he had. And I said, sure. And so that was Tradition Golf, and those are the golf courses that are Legends Club, Willinger's Tournament Club of Iowa, and a number of others. So eventually, after working with them for a long time, I retired a few years ago. And there's an organization that's a not-for-profit organization. It's a tourism-based organization called Explore Minnesota Golf Alliance. It's basically the private sector arm of Minnesota Tourism just for golf. And it's a member-based organization that are those type of courses and resorts that have a client base that's generally has a component that's not local. So there would be destination-style golf courses. So if you're a resort like Madden's, you might get 30% of all your visitors that are outside of the state. So these golf course owners that had courses that were destination-style, about 25 of them, got together and said, we should have a component that addresses the regional, national, and international side of promoting Minnesota as a golf destination, and then trickle it down to our particular courses. And so as I retired, they came to me and said, okay, we need someone to kind of run this together. It's a part-time job, you know. There's a few benefits in it if you want, and they'll give you a check every month and put something together for us, keep us happy, and let's see what we do. So that's what I do. It's a marketing position, and it's a one-man show. And it's a marketing plan, it's execution, whether it's media or golf shows, website, social media, etc. Just kind of feed it the information that comes from these premier golf courses. And through that, you need to know two things. You need to know those courses that are part of it, and you need to know the competition. And so I spend a fair amount of time just getting to know that, and most of the courses that I know people at happen to be members of Explore Minnesota Golf Alliance, and you know, therefore it's easy to communicate with them. It's a great organization, and it's partially supported by the Minnesota Golf Association along with the individual members, and we have a terrific relationship with Minnesota Tourism because we fulfill some of the items that they may not be able to fulfill in terms of if they have a golf writer come in, what are they going to do with them? You know, I can help out with that. If they need some statistics or an overview or...
Of kind of setting up the course or the person's experience so that it's positive.
Right.
Okay.
So.
I don't want to say a charmed life, and you had to work at everything, but you've had such amazing experiences. I always ask one of my concluding questions is if you had a magic wand. If I had a magic wand, I'd live your life. You've done so many neat things. That would be definitely something I'd be interested in. But that's one of my questions always with my guests. If you had a magic wand right now, what would you use it for?
I'd use it for the short term, have a new house, putting a deck on the back, putting a shed out back. Requires a lot of manual labor. That's what I'd use the magic wand for right now.
That you would do the manual labor, or the wand would?
The wand would do the manual labor for you. The wand would take care of everything it has to do with things like that.
Sure. Yeah. It's always interesting to see where people's minds go to, but...
That's what I'm doing this afternoon, so...
Perfect. So you can have that wand. Well, maybe, you know, I'm tempted to just go over there to keep talking to you and hearing more stories. And then the other one is, whose story would you like to hear that's got an association with Minnesota if they're here right now? Who are three people that you'd like to hear from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mentioned just a minute ago the tourism aspect of, you know, of golf. And Minnesota really is one of the most accepted locations and respected locations for golf. I mean, take a look at the types and style of tournaments that people will attend here, you know, the Ryder Cup coming up as a PGA women's tournament. Every single one of the USGA tournaments, male and female, you know, have been here. And part of that relates to the aspect of tourism, the promotion of tourism, mm-hmm. the idea that Minnesota has a lot to, you know, to offer. So as a person that would be an interesting person, you know, I would say someone in the tourism business. Your bank is, you know, located in here in the greater Lakeville area than in Rochester, et cetera. But, you know, Lakeville is close to... the, you know, the area of the greater Twin Cities. So someone in tourism that would be close to the,
sure.
the Twin Cities would be, I think, you know, an interesting individual, not just, you know, for golf.
Yep.
You know, we've got a ski hill over here. We've got a Mall of America here. We've got, you know, a racetrack over there.
And Minnesotans take it for granted a lot, so it'd be good for them to hear, too.
So this area just south of the Twin Cities, is, I think it would be very interesting to talk to someone that has to do with promoting this area.
Sure. Anybody name-wise you could suggest? I'm thinking I'm probably going to interview Brad Maxwell at some point. I know he's a friend and foe of yours on the golf course.
Yeah. Brad's a very, very interesting, you know, individual. He's originally a Manitoban, but spent a lot of time in British Columbia. He is on the all-time list of North Stars that are really, really well known. And he's a really, really good guy. Very good guy.
This is how we have so many. I haven't even talked about your involvement in the Minnesota NHL alumni.
Right.
Maybe I'll leave those talks for when I talk to Brad about.
Brad's the president of it. He is plenty to say, plenty of good things that he's committed a lot of time and a lot of energy to it.
Okay, well, we'll work on those two, and thank you very much for sharing your Minnesota story.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us on Minnesota Stories. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and if there's anybody you'd like to hear from, let us know. We would love to hear their Minnesota story as well.